the Land Use Committee here on March 21st. First up is a public hearing on House Bill 3100. And you want to give us just a little overview on the bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3100 deals with vermiculture, which is regulated by the Oregon Department of Agriculture and is defined as the commercial raising and breeding of worms for use as bait or as an animal food protein source or to produce castings. And what this bill specifically would address is allowing vermiculture as an outright allowed use on exclusive farm use land.
Rep. Johnson, do you want to kick us off?
I'd love to, Mr. Vice Chair.
Worms.
Vice Chair Cameron, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving us this hearing on House Bill 3100, which deals with vermiculture, which is a fancy word for little critters. In our growing diversity within Oregon's, welcome, Chair. In Oregon's agricultural.
He gave me permission.
Chair Clem. As we. In Oregon, obviously, there are many forms of expansion in Oregon's agricultural community. And if we talk about value-added products and trying to maximize our agricultural products to get all of the potential economic benefit out of them, the vermiculture is another growing sector of Oregon's ag industry. And you're going to hear today from a constituent of mine who produces a product, apple juice to be exact, and as you well know, squeezing apples to make juice leaves you with a byproduct. And there are many ways to deal with that byproduct. In some ways you can just haul it off to provide another agricultural use, which creates time and effort and carbon footprint in trucking it from point A to point B. One of the other alternatives is to put it in a controlled environment, add red worm, mealworms to it, and make a potting soil, if you will. It's a wonderful source of fertilizer and benefit for, again, in the agricultural community. So what we're talking about here is just making vermiculture an approved farm use, because I really think that as we continue to grow in value-added economic interests in Oregon, I think this can be a more and more of a popular way to ensure that our ag producers, our farmers, if you will, are being able to utilize their products to the extent that they fully can. So I'm not an expert on the topic, but I do have people behind me who can share what they know about it, and I think there's some food processing people here, too, that would be happy to answer any questions you might have. So with that, in your discretion, Mr. Dr. Chair Clem.
No, I was going to say Reverend Clem.
We will go ahead and pass it off to you. But again, it's just about recognizing vermiculture as an outright farm use, along with many other practices in the statute, many, many others from livestock to, you know, typical agricultural things, and now vermiculture as well.
And that's how the Dash 2s work instead of dealing with the land use part.
The Dash 2 amendments are what are in play, Mr. Chair. Thank you for pointing that out.
How'd you get such a good bill number for your worm farms here, 3100? I've had that bill number two sessions in a row, and you got it for your worm farms, but I won't hold that against everybody else.
That's how many worms are in a cubby.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Okay, any questions for Representative Johnson?
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Okay. And so I've got Julie Euland and David Ryan. Come on up and join us. Welcome to the Land Use Committee. Talk to us about vermiculture.
Well, first I'd like to thank you for allowing us to be here.
Sure.
Chair and members of the committee, it's an honor for us as Hood River Juice Company to represent other farmers and those who make secondary byproducts from their primary products to be able to bring forward a sustainable plan for farmers that's very unobtrusive. And
Julie, sorry, I just got to have you say your name out loud for the record.
Euland.
Yeah, thank you.
Sorry.
We're good. Yeah, it's okay. And then we'll do the same with David. Yeah. Thank you. Sorry.
Uh-huh. No, that's fine. We produce a byproduct, as Senator Johnson said, that is a luscious, nutrient-full pulp that is left over from juicing our apples. And that is being now used as cattle feed, and it has a lot of other benefits that it could go to. One of them is to feed Athena petitus, which is a red wiggler worm that eats half its weight a day in food waste. And what it casts off is this beautiful black gold that is an amendment to the soil that the farmer can use to actually put back into his orchards, his gardens, his any kind of agricultural product that he's using to amend the soil. What it does is not actually a compost. It's an amendment. It has no smell to it. It's not anaerobically processed. It's aerobically processed. So there's no heat to it. There's no smell to the community. It's very, very benign. And it's about the most natural process known since the beginning of time. I mean, worms were eating leaves and waste product, and their byproduct was amending the soil long before any farmer ever figured it out. And there are studies now that are out there, and there's hundreds of companies who are using worm castings to amend their garden soil. So there is a secondary market for this kind of thing should someone want to pursue it. But first and foremost, I mean, to educate the average gardener as to how they might be able to take their own food waste, start a compost bin in their own home, and recycle their own waste is of incredible benefit. And we are hoping to be able to do that on our property and be able to use it as an educational farm as well as to benefit our own waste management.
Well, let's have David talk, and then we'll do questions together, if that's okay.
Chair Klim.
Representative Johnson. I should have. Oh, I did ask for questions for him. Sorry. Yeah, please.
My name is David Ryan, and I am here representing Hood River Juice Company and Ryan Orchards, also one of our farmlands. And right now, what the way that the state sees vermiculture is that it is an agricultural product in which it is regulated by Oregon Department of Ag. They have that option. We want to see it that it is an outright use on farmland, and that's really the simpleness of this. That's really all I have to say.
Great. So the question I have, you talked with Hood River County, and did they give you a feeling it might be a problem?
Yes. That it would end up having to go through conditions of approval.
Yeah, it seems strange to me a little bit, but what kind, did they say, because it's just not clearly something that anybody's doing, or?
Because it's not an outright allowed use.
All farm activities are, so then I'm wondering if they just don't believe this is a real farm activity?
I think what the confusion was and what we kept trying to make very clear to them is this is not a typical composting situation, which would probably need a conditional use permit, because if you were taking manure and heating it, I mean, that's a totally different situation, and that's the whole, they're thinking of this as worm manure.
Yeah. Right.
This is totally different. This has almost no odor. As a matter of fact, if you put your nose in a bag of it, it smells like the richest soil, you know, known to man, because that's what it is. It actually has no pathogens. After the worm takes it through his gut, he gets the pathogens out of the food product that might be, you know, rotting or causing an issue. So really, it shouldn't be considered a compost. However, the county could not get.
You're that. Raising a. Yeah, I can't remember the scientific name. Yeah, that. You're raising a, it's not an animal, but you're raising an organism, and when we raise chickens, they have all kinds of, you know, smelly byproducts, and we allow that as a, you know, dairy. I mean, a lot of stuff when we raise things, they have outright use status already, even though they smell. And you could give me a list over here. So I find it troubling. I mean, not that we can't figure something out for you. I find it troubling that the county doesn't view this as a raising of a, you know, of a. Okay. questions?
That was my question.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out another way to state it, because it seems like this is...
Yeah.
In what universe is this not farming?
Well, I think what happens is the counties want some cover often, and if it's one of the tricks in constructing the land use statutes, if it's not specifically stated, they feel they can get in trouble then for not specifically,
correct,
you know, enforcing the law, because someone might sue them or whatever. And so then you get into these, okay, well, we don't want to have to write every single possible iteration of agriculture down, so we say, I forget the term, but farm use, and then we say buildings in conjunction with farm use, but we don't say wood pole, barn, shed, you know, we just say, and then a county will be like, well, you know, but this one we don't know, so maybe you could put it in the statute. And that's how we find ourselves at these places, right. I think, on some stuff, so...
Nice question.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yep. Representative Unger.
Thanks. Do you have to build facilities to house? I mean, is there lots of construction that goes along with this process? It doesn't sound like it.
Absolutely not. You can actually do it in rows of just dumpage, if that's what you want to do, and put the worms underneath, and they will eat their way through. What this worm does that an earthworm doesn't do is that it stays on the relative surface, and it reconstitutes and massages the soil, basically, and takes the food stuff, and then all of the waste goes underneath. So eventually, it just disappears and looks like a pile of wonderful dirt.
Representative Unger, if you build a building to house the vermiculture, you create an environment that's constant for them and that makes them happy. It's kind of like us. If we're cold, we don't like to move around too much. We want to get warm. So that's kind of that situation.
So there might be a building built to house them.
Or there are existing buildings.
Or, yeah.
Right,
you know,
hoping
we,
for.
So we, you know, we house cows, and unless you're totally free range, you don't just leave the chickens out all the time with nowhere to go, I don't think.
So what we have is on... the farmland is about 7 to 8 acres of virtually unused property that we're trying to figure out how to put something on that would be beneficial to the community, that would be educational. We can work with school systems, teach children.
What an aggregate mine there.
It's a bad joke. Sorry about that. Another landfill.
Yeah.
So...
Do we have anybody from the counties here, or Vice Chair Frederick?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These are the same worms that are used in the schools right now to do in boxes and to clean up waste from the lunches and things like that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I'm still, I agree. I'm struggling with why this is an issue.
I really want to talk to some county person. I'm looking to who I can pick on, but I don't. Is there any AOC people here? And no one from Hood River County? Yeah.
You're probably a stale.
Yeah, well, let's just see if we can find.
Is Thousand Friends, are they going to testify, or do they just submit their written?
Thousand Friends submitted some written testimony. Yeah, they're here if you want to talk to them, probably, too.
Say no. Don't talk about all terms.
Let me just get through. Any more questions for these nice people? Representative Davis, and then
I'm sorry.
Vice Chair Cameron.
I think Cameron's
well,
here.
I
thought we were...
I have one idea.
Yeah, Vice Chair Cameron.
Well, we have time.
We've got to go find these county people.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I buy these worms for my own garden facility, and where would you buy them? On the internet, or?
Vice Chair Cameron, you can go on the internet and just Google vermiculture, and you'll have a dozen local vendors who will sell you. And I would recommend that you are picky. Let me know, and I'll tell you who's a good vendor. But like anything else, you get good and bad worms. California is going nuts with this in their vineyards, and they're using all of that grape pomace, and those vineyardists are using these castings over their vineyards to it's not only a natural disease control, I mean, it's an organic disease control, but they're finding that it also allows their root stock to take root and actually a year earlier than it normally would, because it's just God's natural amendment, you know? It just makes it all happen faster.
It's
great that she would...
Yeah, thank you. Just give me a recommendation, kind of like my dog breeder, and make sure I get the right worm breeder.
It's true.
Yeah. She also is not sure you know how to use the internets. Series of tubes strung together, and you put something to the Google machine. Representative Davis, and then Vice Chair Frederick.
Well, I just wanted to thank you, Chair. Recognize... It seems to me what's happening here is you have some land you want to put to productive farming use to make some money for yourself and help the community, and I just don't see the downside to this. It seems to be farming. I'm reading the farming statute. The written testimony from Thousand Friends says this essentially, well, let them say it, but that to the extent vermiculture is a farm use, it's already allowed. It's just frustrating to me that I see honeybees are specifically mentioned in the statute. Obviously, they came in and requested the same thing, probably in a similar debate. So all that is a comment, I suppose. There's no question in there. And I appreciate your frustration.
Vice Chair Frederick.
I'm just curious about the amount that you're talking about, how much pulp you're dealing with. Do you have a sense? I mean, are you talking about being able to fill up those 7 acres? Or, I mean, how much for your farm, for your orchard? How much you do?
If we had to, and if we desired to have this much, if we took all of our waste away from delivering it all the way from Simplot on the eastern Oregon, delivering it all the way to Tillamook, we would only need in-house on bedding, if it was only one level, 72,000 square feet. That's it.
Okay.
That's how much the worms eat.
That's 2 acres.
It's amazing what we have that we don't use.
Mm-hmm. Urban programs are trying to educate people in their apartments to use these worms. They don't smell. There's a Boise, I was coming in here, there's a Boise restaurant that uses these worms in the basement of the restaurant to reconstitute their food waste. Mm-hmm. And then they take the castings and put them out in their planters. Mm-hmm. And it's gotten so popular, the folks who dine there have heard about it and have come in to actually buy castings from the restaurateur. So it's unimaginable to us as to why this is not a farm use.
And some of our nature stores here are that we sell some of our product to organically. They utilize vermiculture in getting rid of some of their waste.
I have no idea. Thank you.
Apparently, we found a victim, but he won't come in here because he has no idea. So we'll talk to them afterwards to talk to Hood River County about what their, you know, justification was, why they think we need to do it this way versus just telling you can and having this over with tomorrow instead of whenever this would make its way through the process.
Chair Clem, he did say he would find out for us.
Oh, good. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay. And
thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. And I think we've got, do you want to come up? Sure, come on up, Steve. In fact, I think you're the next person on the next bill anyway, so.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I think it's a farm use. Thank you.
Very good testimony. Best testimony of the year.
Any questions?
Perfect.
All right, then. Okay, anybody else here on the vermiculture? Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3100. There's no Brenda Thompson here, right? Okay, and then let's open the public hearing on House Bill 2839. Can I get Steve McCoy? Steve? Do you have any... do you want to bring
I bring Mr. Honeycutt up? I'd like to see you two up at the same time. Come on down.
It's not the first time.
Yeah, no, I know. Got a big look bill out unanimously, too. Both you two learned how to cut deals over the last few years. I like it. So let's see how we did on this one. Steve, why don't you go ahead and get us started?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I am here testifying in support of HB 2839. This is a jobs bill as its primary goal, making industrial lands available for industrial use. The bill does one simple thing and also has a side effect that we'll discuss, I think, at length, probably. First, let me provide a little background. In addition to extinguishing Measure 37, Measure 49 also set up a compensation scheme that prevents land from being zoned out of industrial uses. Specifically, if a local government passes a law that lowers the fair market value of land by restricting the residential use of private real property, then the local government is liable for a claim of just compensation. Just compensation can take the form of a waiver of the land use regulation or of an actual cash payment if any local government actually had cash on hand to pay. This ties the hands of local governments, these prospective aspects of Measure 49. Once something is zoned to allow residential uses, that zoning is sticky. It's difficult to change out of that. Let's look at an example. An owner of residential land situated near light industrial, for example, away from any sort of other residences, could be approached by a large company that wants to expand its facilities. At that point, the company would take an option on the land, or that's what you'd expect. Contingent on the land being rezoned as industrial, landowner would approach the city for a rezone. If the city then rezoned the property to industrial, it would give the landowner a windfall, an immediate windfall at that point, and the industrial user would be able to build. However, the landowner could still file a claim for just compensation under Measure 49 if they could show that the land would have been worth more as residential land, even though they were the ones that requested the rezone. The primary purpose of this bill is to fix that issue, that it's difficult to rezone land to industrial from residential. And the primary purpose of the bill is also within the urban growth boundary. So how does this bill accomplish that? The way that it's written, it exempts from these prospective Measure 49 claims plan changes that plan and rezone land to a zoning classification that allows industrial use. So what types of zones allow industrial use? Obviously, industrial zones. And that, again, is the primary focus of this bill. However, resource zones also allow industrial use, and they are also important job creators. So why is this bill written this way so that it also affects resource lands? Well, as you know, last year, the legislature funded a pilot project for Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties to devise their own definition of farm and forest lands and to then subsequently remap resource lands out of those definitions, out of resource use. Any honest redefinition and remapping of lands could possibly take some lands out of resource use, but logically it could also place lands that are currently not in resource use into resource use, which could trigger a Measure 49 claim against the county. The bill as currently written allows a county to move lands into job-producing resource uses without triggering a Measure 49 claim, and also would allow Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties to fully implement the pilot project. This bill could be easily reworded so that rezoning to resource lands would not be exempted from Measure 49 claims, and I think we're going to be discussing that here. However, this would make that pilot project a one-way street. Lands could be removed from resource use, but lands could not be changed into job opportunities by rezoning into resource-based uses. So you I'm sure, are all tired of hearing me talk about resource jobs, about how agriculture is the second largest industry in the state, one of eight jobs, 15% of economic activity in the state, its traded sector, it's reliant on farmland, so I won't talk about that.
Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure. You want the third largest industry sector is in the state?
Forestry,
correct. It's the third largest industry sector.
Quiet, sorry.
I think I can gavel you down. That's the rule. You helped me a lot. So
it makes up 6.9% of Oregon's total industrial output and contributes on average $12.6 billion a year to the state's economy. According to OFRI, just over a third of timberlands in the state are private, but over three quarters of the timber harvested in the state comes from private lands. So the harvest that takes place today in Oregon is over three quarters on private lands. The harvest supports over 200 mills of varying sizes in the state. Without private timberlands, forestry jobs and the jobs at these value-added processors go away. Lands in private timber production mean jobs. Resource lands mean jobs. So that's why we wrote the bill as we did, and that's why it has the thrust that it does. And we ask that you support this bill to support jobs in Oregon. Thank you.
Okay. Dave, you want to go, and then we'll ask questions
sure.
for both of you.
I wanted to call you the author of Measure 49, but no one else would get that joke, and you might not even think it was that funny. Yeah. So I decided not to say that out loud.
I think you were the author of Measure 49, Mr. Chair.
I'll do my best.
Yeah. Chair Clem.
Senator Przanski is about to come down here, right?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Chair Clem, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking, at least at this point, in opposition to this bill. I had understood this bill to be targeted at what Mr. McCoy indicated was the first issue that he discussed, land inside the urban growth boundary being rezoned from residential to industrial use, triggering a Measure 49 claim, although I'm not sure in the example that he gave how that would happen. If the property was more valuable as residential land, then the property owner wouldn't enter into an option agreement with someone to sell it for industrial use anyway. So I don't see how that scenario works. But nevertheless, you know, it's one thing if we're talking about property inside the urban growth boundary and changing claims and changing Measure 49 claims on property inside the urban growth boundary. It's quite another thing if we're talking about changing Measure 49 claims for any property that's rezoned. In the way that the bill is worded currently, that's what would happen. The language of the bill and the operative language is section 1, sub 3E. It's the bolded language. It's on line 22 of page 1 of the bill. Would authorize or would prohibit a property owner from making a Measure 49 claim for any land that's planned and rezoned to a zoning classification that allows industrial uses. The problem with that language is its breadth. Nearly every zone in Oregon allows industrial uses, from EFU and forest zones to residential zones. I was looking this morning at Washington County's R5 zone. It's a low-density residential zone that Washington County has. One of the zones that we're talking about in the Bonnie Slope bill that you folks already passed out for us and that passed off the floor the other day, that zone allows industrial uses. There's some light industrial uses that are allowed in the R5 zone. So the problem that's triggered by the bill, the way it's worded now, is that basically any time a rezone would occur, whether it's from rural residential to EFU or from R10, 10 units an acre, to R5, 5 units an acre, any of those rezones that would have the effect of destroying or limiting the value of the property would be exempt under this measure, under this bill, from a Measure 49 claim. And I didn't think that that was what was intended in the draft, but maybe that was what was intended in the draft. But that obviously is a very significant change to Measure 49, a measure that obviously that we opposed. But the prospective portion of the measure is something that's very important to us, and we want to make sure that those protections, sold by the
people like me,
by the supporters to the voters, are retained.
Yeah.
And so this causes us much concern if we were limiting it to and talking about properties inside the urban growth boundary, then that's a discussion that we would certainly be willing to have. But if it goes out to outside the UGB and allows a county to, say, take a rural residential property that can be divided into 2 5-acre lots with a home on each and change it to EFU with an 80-acre minimum parcel size and an $80,000 requirement in order to build a home on it, and that person can't file a Measure 49 claim, that would be a big problem for us.
Yeah. Okay, questions for either?
I have a question.
Yeah, Representative Unger. So, Steve, did you intend to include just inside the UGB land, or did you intend to write it the way that Dave says it's currently written?
Chair Clem, Representative Unger, I think the intent was to address two issues, and one would be within the UGB, and the other would be the particular Southern Oregon issue with the executive order. I don't think we ever envisioned that it would be used by Washington County to rezone R5 to EFU. Does it have that effect? It very well could in some circumstances, yes. And we're happy to talk about ways to limit it so that it does what we're intending and doesn't cause heartburn to others.
Thanks. Okay, Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I just wondered, I was having some computer issues, so I didn't quite grasp all your reasons for opposing, but are these irreconcilable differences between the two? Do you think you can find agreement, or you just rather we just left the statute alone?
Chair Clem, Representative Thatcher, I think it's a problem in search, or a solution in search of a problem. That being said, as I've indicated to Mr. McCoy, and I had a phone call with Jason Miner, the executive director of Thousand Friends, yesterday, there may be some work that we could be done and an agreement that could be reached for inside the UGB claims if this bill would apply outside of the urban growth boundary, then we would be, well, we couldn't, wouldn't support it.
You want to follow up?
No, go ahead.
Let me probe that just a little further on the outside of the UGB. Are you, if there's a way to really define industrial, what I'm thinking about now is, you know, the big fish. And if we actually were outside the UGB and in some other bill, which we're looking at, we create some process, it would be really industrial, not ag industrial, like manufacturing. Is there anything there, you think, if we wrote it correctly?
Chair Clem, thank you for reminding me of that conversation that we had had earlier. If that's the case, then sure, that's, If we're talking about taking a use that, an industrial use that currently isn't authorized outside of the urban growth boundary and allowing an industrial use to be authorized outside the urban growth boundary, then sure, that's something that we can talk about.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. But following up on that point, I mean, going one step back in the process, we're talking about a reduction in fair market value being the predicate for this argument. And under that scenario, I believe that would be an increase in the fair market value of the property, especially if this rezone was coupled with a sale. Fair market value is defined in the law as a purchase between a willing buyer and a willing seller. If they make a purchase, which I think was your original point, then there would be no reduction in fair market value, which leads me to what's the point of the bill.
We have our own scheme, I think, for what these appraisals are that are different, don't we, in this case?
Well, Chair Clem, the appraisal method used in Measure 49 is something that you have to pull out your magic eight ball and you know, it's not, well, using technical legal terms, it's confusing.
So you get an appraisal before from, you have to have an appraisal from 1 year before, you have to have another appraisal from 1 year after, and it has to show the reduction in value. And then you've got a figure that you can file a claim,
yes,
based on for waiver or compensation.
Correct. And the appraisal method's a little, I don't think it's your standard appraisal method, but
yeah, I can't remember.
But in any event, yeah, there is a way to do it. But to answer Representative Davis's question, I think that's accurate. You know, it would be hard for me to fathom a Measure 49 claim for say an industrial use outside of a UGB that hadn't previously been allowed, because for the most part, we'd be talking about lands that are either farm or forest zone, because that's what most of the land outside of UGBs is, and I would suspect that would be result in an increase in value. If conceivably, if the land was rural residential and went to some type of rural industrial, then maybe. But I don't think that's very likely.
The only scenario I'm thinking of is, let's say somebody has EFU and they meet the minimum acreage requirements for a dwelling, or maybe they have enough for two. They don't really want to build it. And somebody gets the ability, you know, a big fish gets the ability to go right next to them, says, look, we'll buy this deal. You're not going to have to spend the money building the house. We'll buy it. We don't know when we're going to use it, but we'll buy it. We want to get it rezoned. Somebody rezones it for them as part of some process to get it rezoned. Theoretically, they lost more value on the residential potentially than what they got for it, but it saved them the hassle having to build the house and do all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's far-fetched, but that's yeah. That's the only thing I can think of.
May I address that? Yeah.
Well, we're talking about your bills if you're not here. But
yeah. Yeah, right. Thank you, Chair Clem. Another issue I think there is the chilling effect that it has on local governments. So it's not so much would a claim be successful or could a claim be brought, it's would a local government change its decision making based upon the possibility that a claim could be brought.
And if the goal is to get more industrial zoning in various places, you want to be helpful to try and help it.
Correct.
Representative Davis.
Oh, thank you, Chair.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. Thank you. So are you thinking of prospective rezones as opposed to where you have the big fish that's come? You already essentially have material deal terms worked out on a letter of intent or something with the landowner, which establishes a price. Okay. You're talking about if the jurisdiction wants to prospectively turn residential into a industrial zone and then try to market it more broadly? I'm just trying to get at your example.
Chair Clem, Representative Davis, I think under both circumstances it could have a potential chilling effect on the local government. Because there's uncertainty there in the, in what the appraisals are going to be and how things are going to work out, I think that does make it more difficult for local governments to make decisions.
Thanks.
I do have a few more witnesses, too, so you can take another stab if they bring something up. If you two gentlemen don't leave, that'd be nice. Okay, so thank you, and let me call up Alana, and then Mel Conrad and Tom Lewis. You want to go ahead and join us? Okay. Alana, you're first.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Guinea. While I don't have 1,000 friends, I do represent the Oregon AFL-CIO and our 250,000 members. I apologize for trying to be funny. We spend a lot of time in this building looking at ways to incentivize, create, and maintain good jobs. And frankly, we see one of the number one needs for good jobs as a strong industrial land base. We believe we need all the tools we can get to create that strong industrial land base, and our interest in this bill arose when we looked at the language and thought about the chilling effect that you heard about from the last panel, actually. We see that chilling effect as a barrier to creating new industrial land. We support anything we can do to remove barriers to creating new industrial land and maintaining our industrial land base, and for that reason, we are supportive of this bill. I'm happy to let the experts who are up here before work out the details of what the exact language should be, but as long as that language can help address that concern and not back off ensuring that we have that land base, we will remain supportive. Thank you.
So, Mel, why don't you go first? Welcome.
Yes, Chair Clem and members of the panel. My name is Mel Conrad, and I am giving testimony here today representing the oppositional view presented by the Oregon Citizens Lobby. The bill, as you see introduced, gives the words right at the top, exempts from entitlement to just compensation. In other words, we are viewing that as the fact that it denies just compensation for private properties, for property owners whose land is rezoned in for industrial use. McCall, Governor McCall, 40 years ago, through his own testimony, identified that Oregon touted the most strict land use laws in the nation. Over those years and to this day, there have been some unintended consequences, which have included more inventories of commercial, residential land that have been denied, business opportunities decreased, the interference in marketplace land development, the outcome of artificial shortfall of industrial land in specific areas. And the bottom line here for us is the tendency to view this as a confiscation of the land from citizens without just compensation. The Oregon Citizens Lobby would request that you vote in opposition for this bill. Thank you.
Thanks, Mel. And Tom.
Yes, and Chairman Clem. I'm Tom Lewis from Corvallis, and I also agree with the previous speaker, Ms. Conrad, in that I also oppose the bill.
Okay, questions for this panel? One comment I might make on your point, Alana, on the chilling effect. I think this actually ties back to the worm bill, so it sounds strange, but hear me out. I think sometimes we really are quite confident that something is a farm use, but these county planners or county officials are out there, A, wondering when we might involve ourselves telling them they were wrong, or B, just not totally sure they're on certain footing, so they take precautionary moves like telling him he can't have his worm farm, go to the legislature. And so normally I would, I think I've been a little bit skeptical at the idea that there was a chilling effect, but I guess I'm coming around a little bit on the idea that not everybody knows Measure 49 the way some of us do, and so sometimes just not being sure what that appraisal method is. How risky is that really? And you're some city planning commissioner, not totally sure whether you ought to take an action or not. And I think that's an interesting point anyway. Okay, please. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I'm pretty hopeful we can work something out there. If you need some help from any of us, let us know. But I've had a few conversations with each of the Oregonians in Action and Thousand Friends. I think we could probably get some of that language worked out and see you at another point in our busy agenda. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2839. Okay, so here is the situation on these other bills. We're going to carry over all of them, but is Aaron here? Can you come up, Aaron? So let me
let's just talk. Let me open a it's not really a public hearing. Let me just open a work session on 2028 so we can hear what Aaron and I are both sort of talking about, and then we'll go through the other ones in a moment. So open a work session on House Bill 2028. So this is the issue with people. Under what conditions should they be signing non-remonstrance agreements against their will versus when should they sign them, whether they like it or not? And we had some conversations in committee about building permits. Mr. Landauer, who's welcome to come up if he wants, but you know, I'll say what I say. You think he talked about soft services, other services? Nobody wants to come up, or even in the room today. And Aaron and I thought we were probably not going to end up at the same place. Now I'm not so sure, but for your consideration, I think, there's a couple ways to go about this. The way that the league had drafted based on the conversation initially was just building permits, and that you wouldn't have to sign a non-remonstrance agreement if you were just going for a building permit. I looked at that, thought there's probably some other kinds of services that they do. So I asked for some amendments that said not, essentially, the way the amendments at Dash 2s are drafted, they say you
go ahead. You cannot require it for any urban service except for water and sewers, right. I believe how the Dash 2 is currently.
Sorry, I'll have you identify yourself. Sorry. That's my fault.
Aaron Doyle with the League of Oregon Cities.
So I basically said you know instead of trying to list what you could require it on or what you could not require it on, blanket you can't require it on anything except these two things, and we think there may be some work we could do to get either something in the middle or even have it drafted differently for discussion purposes. It shows the whole list of what we're talking about, and then sort of go through it and say, well, the library card, you know, no, you shouldn't get hostage when you, I'm going to keep using that, you should get hostage when you go for your library card, or, you know, X, Y, and Z. And maybe there's some in there that, you know, it is more legitimate, people will feel. So anyway, that's, I think, where we're sort of at, and that's why we're going to carry this over and keep talking about this for a little while longer.
I agree. I think part of the problem at this point is that urban services isn't well-defined in statute at this point, and the only place where it is defined is very narrowly tailored to the urban service agreement context, and that list itself does not even include building permits as a service, so it would be a really bad reference to get to the crux of the issue. So I think we can continue the conversation about what list would be appropriate in which direction.
So then I just wanted to explain that to committee, take any input from members about that. You know, if you think the non-remonstrance agreements are appropriate in all cases, obviously it doesn't really matter to you. You should just vote no on the bill. But if you're interested in this, give some feedback, would be appreciated. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Aaron. Could you, Chair Clem has talked about sewer and water, and the rationale being those are large services brought out, so it makes sense that you'd have to be brought in, annexed. Are there others that you would add to that list?
Tara Clem, Representative Davis, at this point, we're still trying to figure out what services we even do extraterritorial agreements for. And one I would consider is possibly road maintenance might be a heavy investment thing. I don't know how our public, we do have a few municipalities that provide public utilities like electrical service, and that might also have a similar situation as water and sewer as far as infrastructure goes. I don't feel comfortable enough just limiting to those four things at this point. I need more feedback from my members and looking at what we can and can't define from that list. The list for me kind of was all over the place, and I mean things like libraries has never been something we require annexation for. Instead we just do the
charge them a fee for
a card, and that's how we do it.
Yeah. We know the truth.
Right, yeah.
So that's that. It's just a need of more information as far as what should be excluded or just what should be included as a concern to you.
Follow up.
And I don't bring the question to put you on the spot just because this is a conversation you guys have been having and trying to think about policy rationale in front of the entire committee. So I'm not putting you on the spot. Don't mean to hold you to any of this. I just appreciate you
riffing a little bit. We don't need to hold you hostage.
Any other
loss and misses in this committee?
Come on, nobody? Nobody? Seriously?
I am looking for input on this.
I'll give you my
input.
Thank you. I'll give you my input. I'm probably tending to lean more towards the way you started out with the major utilities. And I think that the fact the water, sewer, and then if it's a utility provided by the city, I think things that are provided by the city would probably be the things that I would say legitimately could be on that list for the major utilities.
One point, last session we talked about ongoing services versus temporary services. That time I didn't have someone so helpful as Aaron actually, it's not so much Aaron. It was, I had somebody who's a good lawyer, didn't want to help me get the bill passed, so really didn't want to help me write it better. So I ended up losing it because I couldn't quite get it written correctly, and I gave up on it myself even. So I do appreciate your willingness to, even if you end up being neutral or opposing, whatever the league calls it when you finally get rolled by somebody, but you do it quietly. I do appreciate that. It helps us write the bill better.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Holby.
I think another one that might be up for consideration is sometimes police service, fire service, those sorts of services also are sometimes provided by cities to unincorporated areas inside UBGs. So, and I know they're not exactly cheap either.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll, any more input on that from folks? I think we're thinking about how to get a list together for people to actually see what we're talking about, because we're going to have to draft this at some point. And there's, I think, Mr. Landauer, I almost called you Representative Landauer, Mr. Landauer talked about a list for shared revenue purposes that exists, an itemized list, or maybe it was Mr. Green. There's a shared revenue list of services, but we'll see if we can come up with some whole list of services. Or do it the other way, say everything but these things are exempt from this bill, and then figure out what they are. Probably makes the cities nervous, but this gets back to the point of local government versus the legislature wanting something that you actually enforce or not in vague terms. Representative Holder.
Mr. Chair, wouldn't it be simpler just to require annexation inside the UGB?
It would be simpler.
One more.
I think that you do have a bill probably somewhere that I don't know about on that. It's like a priority bill waiting. But
it's in rules.
Yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. Oh, boy. That's where they go after the deadline. Now I'm going to not sleep for a few weeks. Okay. Okay. So let's close the work session on House Bill 2028. And I'd be shocked by Tuesday, but just so I don't have to repost in case we work a miracle, I'll carry over the work session on 2028. And I'll just, I won't go through the whole deal again. On 22617, which is the limitation on islands, there's no point in talking. They feel philosophically about the islands, no limit. Mr. Landauer, I think, would like it if I'd crank it down and by amendment to a much lower limit. I'm probably not going to do that. So just committee members, think about that. I'm trying to not have an annexation vote till I've, A, obviously talk to you and make sure it doesn't fail right in front of me, and B, do it all in one day. So anyway, that's where we're at on that one. And then, so let me carry over House Bill 2617. The work session on House Bill 2617. And then the last one, 2618, we think, again, we maybe were in different places, and we may be able to end up in the same place. And we're not sure, but we think so. So Mr. Landauer may not get his way entirely, but I think that Aaron and I are closer than you two are. So we're going to keep talking about that. This has to do with under what conditions a city can withdraw if they're not going to actually provide the service. And, do they take the taxes in? Is it an intergovernmental agreement? How does that work? And we think maybe we're going to get somewhere. So we'll see. To be determined on that one. so I can carry over House Bill 2618 as well. Any questions on that or anything else from anybody? Okay, 4 o'clock. I will need to adjourn the committee.